sometimes two people meet and it just seems like they were supposed to. It almost seems like they were made for each other. Such is the case for today's guest, Carmen Ash. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. Carmen is here today to talk about a story that has taken her a lifetime to live and 7 years to write. Carmen is the author of I Have a Purpose. Carmen, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Now, Carmen, there was some guy named Tony who actually played a significant role in your life. I want you to tell us how you first met Tony, and I need you to tell us about that Levi suit.
Well, Pamela, we first met on by coincidence. My girlfriend was trying to teach me how to pick up a guy, and we were just kind of joyriding around, and she noticed two guys in the car, and she said, "Oh my God, they're so cute." So she was insistent on trying to go and meet them, and he actually paid her no mind. And when I glanced over, he was looking at us, and he kind of did the pretty please sign, and I spoke with him, and we just connected. And then we went on our first date, and sure enough, I opened the door of my mother's apartment, and we actually had the same suit on. It was a mustard color green Levi suit, which back in the 80s, you know, that's what, you know, we were wearing. And we just started laughing. And from that moment on, it was, we just knew. We kind of just was pulling each other in, the connection, the vibe, everything was just automatic. It was just so incredibly natural to be around him. And I felt safe.
You felt safe. Why was safety an issue for you? How old were you, by the way, and how old was he when you met?
I was 18, and he was 21. He's 4 years my senior. And when I say I felt safe, my childhood had, I was kind of apprehensive about men. I had been molested by my oldest brother. And then I had an ex-boyfriend who was a stalker, and he was also extremely violent towards me. And my dad was a very domineering, I don't want to say typical, but a very macho kind of man, where what he said was the law, and women were beneath him. So I kind of grew up with being very standoffish against men. And meeting Tony allowed me to feel safe again, and that's why I said safe. It was just so natural for me to talk to him and be myself, and him just listening and not judging, and it was so beautiful, Pam. Honestly,
you said that you were molested by a brother. How old were you when that happened?
I was 7 years old.
7 years old.
I was 7 years old, Pamela. It was. I didn't understand what had occurred, so I never spoke about it until Tony. Once Tony and I started getting serious about each other, and then eventually we got married, I let my guards down, and I let him into some very deep and dark emotions that I was experiencing that I had bottled up and never shared with anyone. You know, so it was kind of, I knew it happened, but I didn't talk about it. It was a taboo topic, and, you know, did this really happen? For a long time, every time I saw my brother, it was, did he really do that to me? You know, and kind of, I had to come to terms with the emotions and what had transpired.
And you said that you didn't tell anyone, and that's not unusual. Certainly when a family member harms another family member, there are all kinds of reasons why the child would be afraid to tell someone. In your household, talk about the dynamic between your mom and your dad.
Well, my father was the provider. For that kind of generation, you know, the man went out and worked, and the woman was home taking care of the kids. Nothing unusual. You know, she was in charge of, the household. Well, he provided. It was what he said. There was never, I want to do this. We always did what my father wanted to do. And my mother was very submissive, you know, never wanting to have any type of confrontations. I never actually saw my parents argue or pitch in their voice or anything like that. So to me, when I experienced the domestic abuse by my ex-boyfriend, you know, that was a whole different world for me. I couldn't understand it. But back to my mother, she kind of just went along with the flow. Or, you know, we had 4 o'clock, we ate dinner. Everything was in sync with what my father wanted to do and never what she wanted to do.
Okay, so there was a real clear routine in the house. There were real clear expectations.
Absolutely, absolutely. We went to church on Sunday. We ate at 4 o'clock. We watched whatever channels, shows he wanted to watch. There was never, oh, I want to do this, or anyone giving an opinion. It was what he said, and that was it.
You know, you talk about something in your book, I Have a Purpose, that a lot of times folks don't really talk about, and that is the complexion issue. You talk about the way in which your father viewed himself based on his complexion and the way that he viewed your mom, and in fact, how he treated your mom as his view of her complexion. Are you comfortable talking a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Very, very hard to, initially it was extremely difficult for me to come to terms with it, but my father was a fair-skinned Puerto Rican man, while my mother was the dark Puerto Rican. And I recall my mother telling me that my dad used to have her clean my grandmother's house. And it was always what he wanted because, you know, and as she got older, you can tell that she had resentment but really never spoke about it. And even while we were little, I recall my father always making derogatory comments when there was a dark-skinned person involved. And, you know, in my book, I say, I don't know if subconsciously we all went with our black side because of what my father had instilled in us. It was like, because you said this, this is what we're going to do, because at some point, my siblings and I were either married or engaged to actually a black person, you know. So I always wonder if what my father had said to us, that, you know, not to us, he just was venting, but really, you know, if subconsciously that's the way we went because of what he was saying about dark-skinned people. You know, it wasn't just black. It was just anybody of dark skin.
To anybody from anywhere who had a complexion darker than what he thought was acceptable.
Exactly.
And it sounds like you're saying he would send your mom to his mom's house to clean. He thought that was reasonable because of your mom's darker complexion.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is, you know, I couldn't understand it because my parents were Puerto Rican, and it's the same nationality, but for some reason, he looked at the pigmentation as lower if you were darker. You know, which it still baffles me. I'm not even going to, you know, to try to understand it. I guess it's the generation, you know, my father's from an older generation. He's up in his 80s now, so, you know, that's what I've given it up to.
I'm not sure that it's just your dad's generation. You know, the issue of color and complexion is one that haunts perhaps us worldwide. I was about to say this country, but perhaps it is worldwide. The issue of looking to find a way to separate me from you, just worldwide. I think we still, as human beings, struggle with that. But it's an interesting dynamic that, again, I think that very often people don't talk about, particularly among African-American families, Latino families. It just, it's not talked about. So I was interested and that you were able and willing to talk about it in I Have a Purpose. When you began to date the person you've named as Corey, the person who was abusive to you, talk a little bit about that. How did your mother and father feel about Corey? First of all, what did Corey look like? Did he meet your father's appearance criteria?
No, not at all. Not at all. Totally opposite.
So your father would have been opposed to Corey just based on his looks?
Oh, absolutely.
And absolutely. Corey began to do what kinds of things? When in the relationship did you start to experience the violence of Corey that you referenced a few moments ago?
I would say it was about 6 months to a year into the relationship. And I grew up in a very strict Catholic upbringing. But what my parents did for me that they didn't do for my siblings were they actually allowed me to have a boyfriend because of what they experienced with my other siblings. They were trying to, I guess, do things differently. So they did allow me to have a boyfriend, whether they agreed with it or not. I guess they were trying to Americanize themselves. And although they may not have agreed with him, they allowed me to have him as a boyfriend. And at first, you know, the representative was just totally amazing. He was extremely charming and so forth. And then it became verbal abuse. And as I mentioned earlier, I never experienced that in my household, so I didn't understand that. And then it became physical, physical to the point that he broke my nose, he smashed my head through the window, and he cut me. So it was something that I had never experienced, and how do I get out of this situation? Just to backtrack a little bit, although my parents had allowed me to have a boyfriend, I eventually had sex with Corey, and I shared my my excitement with my sister, who in turn told my dad, and my dad, being a macho kind of man, said, well, you have to get married because you decided to have sex. And I knew that that wasn't going to happen because he made my sister go through the same thing. And I said, I'm not getting married. He said, yes, you are. So I ran away from home, not running to be with Corey per se, but running away from my dad's demand. And this is where I experienced all the abuse.
And how old were you? How old were you? You were 16.
I was 16.
Okay.
I was 16. And interesting enough that my mom met me every day at the train station just to see me so her and I can talk, because I was in high school, and she kept saying, make sure you go to school, make sure you go to school. And I used to tell her, Ma, I'm going to school, don't worry about it. And she said, I have to go because your father's coming. So in her own way, she defied my father's rules and, you know, met me every day to check on me, to make sure that I was okay to the extent that she could.
And you were living where when you left home?
I was living with Corey and with his family.
And how did they accept you?
If this makes any sense, it was kind of natural for them. They had everyone living there, so I was just another person. And that was also a shocker for me because I wasn't used to this arrangement. You know, I had a strict routine, you know, upbringing, and here I am entering someone else's apartment, and it's kind of a free-for-all. You know, no one was disciplined. No one had any kind of rules. So I was in shock.
I can imagine.
You know, I went from a quiet household to, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, people were coming in the house, you know, and then growing up, you know, the doors and the chain was on at 9 o'clock in my house. You know, no one was coming in or going out. So here I am in a totally different environment, seeing things that I never knew about, you know, so I was exposed really quick to very unsavvy things, you know, to keep it mildly.
So here you are, you're 16, you've run away from home, you're living in Corey's household, and things are, as you say, to put it mildly, a little wild and crazy. How long did you stay in that environment?
I stood in the environment for about a year, a good year, trying to figure out what was my next plan. And after, you know, I was getting beat and hit in front of other people, and not one person came to my rescue. So it was kind of a normalcy in that household. And I was not ready to go back to my parents' house, but I knew I had to get out of this environment. So I kind of found my way. I had a girlfriend who allowed me to stay at her apartment, you know, with her parents, which were what I was used to for a little while. But I was so afraid of Corey now harassing them and scaring and intimidating my friend and her family, I ended up going back home. You know, my mother said, you know, you could swallow your pride and come back home.
And that's what you did.
And that's what I did.
Carmen, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up here and continue the conversation about I Have a Purpose. Carmen Ash, folks, don't go away. We'll return in just a moment.
Thank you.
Carmen, it's interesting that you stayed in school even after running away from your home. So many children in that situation would not have continued to go to school. What was it about you and school that had you continuing on in school, do you think?
My mother had instilled the importance of education. She kept, although she never went to college and so forth, she would always say, with education, you can go, doors will open for you. Do not fall victim. Continue your education. Continue your education. And that was always instilled with all of us, especially my youngest brother and I. She kind of drilled that, the importance of education in order to better ourselves in the future.
How many of there were you? How many?
Five.
Five. Okay. So
there was five of us.
Five of you and your mom and dad.
Yes.
So it was a pretty crowded household.
Extremely crowded. It was extremely crowded, and it was a three-bedroom apartment. So when my oldest two brothers enlisted in the Army, we kind of felt freedom. We had so much space, we didn't know what to do, you know, but at first it was extremely crowded.
The reason that you stayed with Corey, so many people from the outside looking in, when they hear about people in abusive relationships, you know, the knee-jerk response is, well, why didn't she just leave? Why didn't he just leave? Can you just say a couple of things about what it was that kept you there? I mean, you were a child, and you, it sounds like you didn't have any options, but in addition to that, so many people in abusive relationships don't believe they have options. Talk a little bit about why you stayed.
First, I stood because I was scared, because he kept threatening me, and I had never been exposed to that. And I had seen what his capabilities, so I had the fear that he was actually going to live out his actions. And when I say live out, he kept saying, well, if you leave me, I'm going to kill your mother. Because that was, you know, my mother was my soft spot. I'm going to find you and kill you. So I was young first, naive, and scared. But then the voice inside of me kept saying, no, you have to get yourself out of this. You have to get yourself out of this. No one's going to help you but you. And because I would say I put myself in that situation because of my decision, I had to find a way to get myself out of it, because I did not want to involve anyone else and him to bring harm to someone that I loved. So I just had to figure a way out. I kind of always knew I was getting out, but just having a plan.
Having a plan when you're leaving, particularly an abusive relationship, is critical. It's life-saving critical. What would you say to young women who may be listening to our conversation today, who may find themselves in an abusive relationship? What would be a first line of advice you would want to offer them?
Have a plan.
Okay.
Before you decide to leave or get out, make sure you have a plan of action, and you need support. No man's an island. You cannot do this by yourself. In today's society, there is so many programs to help women to get out. And if you feel too embarrassed, we all have that one family or a friend that we can turn to, and they can help us get to the next, you know, level. But I would say it's never, ever be too embarrassed to ask for help. And you should not be ashamed, and you should not hold the guilt, because it's not you that's the problem. It's the other person.
excellent advice. The shame and the blame belongs with the person who's engaging in the violent behavior.
Absolutely. And sometimes we as women tend to look at ourselves. What did we do wrong? We did absolutely nothing wrong. It's the individual.
And certainly in abusive relationships, that's what the abusers do. They blame the person they're harming for the fact that they're being abused.
Absolutely.
Let's fast forward to that momentous wedding day with Tony. Talk about that wedding day.
Oh, wow. He woke up and he said to me, he turned to me and I was in bed and he said, let's get married. I said, of course. And he said, no, let's get married now. And I said, okay. Again, I'm still young. I'm naive. And he had made me feel so safe. So Tony was always afraid of, I shouldn't say afraid. He just didn't like getting on the trains. So he said, let's drive downtown. And if you're from New York, you know there's no way you can park downtown.
Not anywhere.
And I nowhere. And I said to him, no, let's take the train because we're not going to find parking. And he's like, no, let's drive, you know. So that's what I refer. I never say Tony and I had arguments. We had passionate discussions. That was one of our first passionate discussions. But I let him win. We go downtown. He finds a parking per se. We go to City Hall. And the judge is like, okay, so where's your witness? Now, we kind of looked at each other like, oh, you need a witness? And this older black lady was sitting there waiting for someone else. And she says, I don't mind being your witness. And you just felt the love from her. So we went and we got married. When we left City Hall, sure enough, there was a ticket on a car, and I told him, I said, I told you, and next thing you know, he was dropping me off at work.
Now that's a wedding day.
Yes.
How did your, you described yourself as growing up in a good Catholic household. Weddings tend to be a big deal. They're in the church. I mean, how did your folks take this?
Oh, my God. I was more, the respect has always been more for me towards my mom than what my father felt or believed, because his idea of a woman was different from mine. And my dad would always say to me, you're the way you are because of your mother, you know, and it was supposed to be, you know, a disciplined comment, you know, and actually I used to always say to him, thank you, it's a compliment, you know. He blamed my feistiness, my independence always on my mom, you know, but that day when we got home, Tony says to me, you better tell your mom because you know how she is. And I said, I know, I better walk over there and tell her. He says, okay, well, go. I'm not going with you. You have to deal with this on your own. So he let me walk these two blocks, and they felt like the longest blocks ever. And I was having palpitations, anxiety. Oh, my God, my mother, what is she going to say? You know, and that was my really, my one and only concern was my mother. And when she was in the kitchen, as she's always been, you know, cooking, and I looked over to her and I said, Ma, I got married. And she did the sign of the cross at least about 10 times. And she looked over to me and she said, if you're happy, Carmen, I'm happy for you. And that's unconditional love.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking about your life and certainly the challenges, and there were many by the time you and Tony had married, more than anyone should have to bear. And then things became even more of a challenge. Anyone who has an opportunity to read I Have Purpose will learn about the challenge even of your birth and interestingly of Tony's birth as well. So it's interesting that the two of you actually came together. I say all that to say, with all the things that had gone on in your life, with all the challenges and the trauma, finally you were married. Life, in theory, was going to be wonderful. And then there came a time when Tony, the love of your life, went to prison. What happened?
That was a very difficult time in my life, one of. And I was faced with, do I divorce him? Do I wait? What should I do? But something within me knew that I was going to wait. It was, you know, saying I'm committed is one thing, but the day-to-day was extremely difficult. I have a very small circle, and, you know, not to divulge the book, but basically he was protecting someone that I loved and didn't think about the consequences behind his actions and what they were going to do for his family, you know. So he ended up in jail, and he knew he owned it. It wasn't like he was running or making excuses. It was just a matter of, should I take it to trial or should I just plea? And because of how our judicial system is, he knew that it was better to take the plea and do his time. And he did 11 years. 11 years, and I waited. And I look back on that time, and I say that everything happens for a reason. That's one of my many sayings, is everything happens for a reason. That time allowed me to grow, to understand myself better. It allowed him to grow. It allowed him to understand himself and us as a couple. You know, so I was able to continue my education, better myself in order to better my family. So I look at that part of my life as, yes, it was a tragedy, but it happened for a reason. And because of that, what occurred, it allowed me to grow and better myself.
Now, you're saying that Tony was in jail for 11 years. And Tony was not the only person who told you that you could leave him. I mean, you had people around you who were saying, this is a long time, and maybe you need to get on with your life. But you chose to remain in your marriage, to keep your family together. That is such, I would think, a hard decision to make, or perhaps it wasn't.
It was not in a sense of my love for him. It was hard living it day to day. My mother was actually the one person who kind of told me, you're too young, what are you doing? You can find yourself someone else and move on. What are you wasting your life waiting for him? You know, that's the end of it, you know. My heart told me different. my heart told me, stay. I find that in a relationship, in any relationship, it's easy to walk away than to try to make it work. It's difficult. A relationship is difficult because it's every day, you know, trying to understand the individual and moving on. But I believe that when you make these commitments, it's for better or for worse, for sickness and in health. And although we may take those words and say, well, we're going to live happily ever after, sometimes that's not our reality.
Now, there are people who, in relationships where their spouses are not separated from them for years, but, you know, perhaps the relationship doesn't go well or it's not working in the way that they would like, find themselves being unfaithful in the relationship. Was that something that you ever considered as he was in jail?
No, not at all. I was in love with Tony. I still am in love with Tony. It was just having to cope and channeling this love into something that was going to benefit us. And that's why I was going to school during the day and working at night and vice versa. So I was able to have a routine that consumed most of my day. So there was no time to think about other things or what should I do except for nighttime. That's when I was the loneliest.
And how would you navigate the nighttime?
I cried myself to sleep plenty of nights. Plenty of nights I cried myself to sleep. But then I would wake up and I have two beautiful children. They're not children, but they will always be children to me. My son and my daughter, Ellie and Tony, they kind of kept me going when I had lost hope, when I had thought I had reached the end. You know, these little kids did not ask to be brought into this world. They did not, they're not responsible for what was occurring to their father. So I had to provide them some sort of normalcy.
And that you did.
I tried. I tried my very best to give them some sort of a stable foundation. And looking back, you know, I have very healthy, mentally and physically and emotionally healthy grown man and a woman.
Who will always be your babies.
Yes.
It'll be our little secret. I won't tell them. Carmen, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like to pick up with what things were like when Tony finally came home.
Absolutely.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Carmen Ash, who is the author of I Have a Purpose. We'll be right back. Carmen, the day finally came when Tony came home from jail. So then everything was magically wonderful, yes?
Absolutely not.
What was he like when he came home from jail?
Oh, my God. It was a huge adjustment. For some reason, I thought that we would just pick up where we left off when he was home. I had to realize that this man had changed. And if this marriage was going to work, I had to allow him that time to adjust back to society. Although he was intact, so much had changed. So it was unfair for me to expect the same man that he was once was, as it was unfair for him to expect the same woman. We had both changed. So I had to allow that time, and especially with my poor kids, they were like, "Ma, what's wrong with Daddy?" You know, he was programmed. So there were things that he was doing, sheltering his food when we sat there at the table as a family. And I had to realize that I guess he had to shelter his food, you know, in the hall where they ate, because I guess another inmate would take it. So these are things that he had to get out of his system, because he was so conditioned to being alert, being any little thing he would hear, and the kids was like, "Ma, what's wrong with Daddy?" You know, and I tried to provide them, and Daddy's okay, don't worry. But at some point, Pamela, I said to myself, "Oh my God, is this what I waited for?"
Understood.
You know, and that's the reality. But then I had to step back and realize that he needed adjustment. You know, there was still, you know, he was in the era that the payphones, it was something as simple as that. You know, I recall our drive down, and he's looking out the window, and no one was saying anything, and he said, "There's no payphones." And I kind of looked at him weird, like, "Of course there's no payphones," not realizing that
right.
Society has changed so much.
That's,
you know, so
yeah.
Allowing him that time to get acclimated with what had transpired in the world, getting used to not having to get up at 5 o'clock because someone's telling you, getting used to being able to open the refrigerator and not having to worry about someone telling you to go to the bathroom. I mean, it was huh. as simple as that, where we were taking it for granted, but it was an adjustment. It was a huge adjustment for him.
So when you say that he would shelter his food, he would cover his food from the rest of the folks at the table?
From me and the kids.
Hmm.
You know, it was kind of like he was kind of bent over the plate, and he had one arm just kind of hugging the plate, as if, you know, at any moment someone was going to take it, and he was protecting it. It was as simple as that, and we were, you know, kind of like, "Oh my God, what's going on with him?" And realizing that he didn't have to be so protective anymore.
So culture shock for the entire family.
Extremely, to say the least. You know, it was one thing of adjusting to him as a wife, because now, you know, I was the captain, so it was always what I said, go, and that was the routine, and I was never questioned by anyone, because, you know, the children just followed whatever mommy said. So here I am now saying, "Okay, let's go," and hearing someone say, "But where are we going and why?" And I'm looking like why are you questioning me? You should just get up and go. And realizing that, no, he's his own man. If this was going to work, we needed to communicate. And I couldn't be the dictator of the Ash family, which was very hard for me because I was doing it for so long
right.
by myself.
In your view, he had been in jail now for 11 years. Was there anything that was offered to him as an individual or to you as a family to prepare him for what was going to be in so many ways a completely different life? Or did they just say, see ya, and just he was gone?
You know, I think that's what lacks in the system. It's preparing the individual as well as the family members for that transition. For us, it was okay, see you, you know. And I recall, you know, him telling me that, you know, the correctional officer turned to him and said, Ash, I'll see you here again. And he looked at him and he said, you'll never see me back here again. You know, it was kind of like a normalcy for them. You know, and he vowed that if given an opportunity, he would actually never go back. And he was a man of his word, and he adapted to society, completed all the requirements. But the lack of transition and the support that, you know, society does not give the families. And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of these guys go back, because there is not a support, because the families are not prepared. Because it's easier to say, well, he's crazy, you know, and not adjust, because it's an adjustment for everyone.
Right. One of the things that is so critical when someone is released from prison is the ability to find a job, because as you know, so many people aren't going to hire you if you have a record. What happened with Tony? Was he able to secure employment?
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Tony, you know, this is one of the many things why him and I connected, his work ethic. You know, Tony worked 12, 13-hour days without any kind of hesitation, and he was released. And 2 days later, he was employed.
Wow.
2 days later, he was employed. He did not believe in pity, sob stories. He did what he had to do and continued. And from working, he ended up owning his own barbershop, because he was a barber all his life, and a very well-known barber back in the 80s. You know, so to him, it came natural, and just the doors opened up. The community was extremely accepting and supportive, and never did he look back and say, oh, poor me. And because of that, he was able to give other guys opportunities, because he understood that we have to help each other.
So, in fact, he was able to do some. He was really fortunate, because, as you know, so many people don't have that kind of acceptance
right.
within the community or outside the community. They just don't have that kind of opportunity.
Yes. Like I mentioned, the community was very accepting. The owner of the barbershop knew him prior to. So he immediately said absolutely, because he knew his capabilities, never questioned Tony whether anything negative. It was absolutely come aboard. And, you know, from there he was at that barbershop for about a year, and eventually he went to open up his own, because he has, in the past, before he went to jail, he had owned his barbershop. So he always had that entrepreneur making, you know, having my own, you know, approach to things, but understanding that there was a procedure that he had to go through and he had to comply. And my God, the procedure itself, you know, involved all of us at some point, and I had to remind him that I was not on parole. You're on parole. You needed to be home at a certain time. And then I realized that in order to make this work, I had to kind of, you know, calm down and support this man that I waited for such a long time. But it was kind of, we all had to get on the same page, Pamela. And at first it was extremely difficult with the adjusting. But I would say 6 to 8 months, we had a routine. And it was as if he was always home.
You know, it sounds like in so many ways when one member of the family is in jail, kind of like the family is in jail, and when one member is on probation or parole, sounds like the family is as well.
Right. And the dynamic of the family has to be that we're all on the same page. There was never any kind of confusion with the kids, with him, because although he was not physically in the household, we were on visits constantly, and he called, so he knew everything that was going on with the kids. So when he came home, for them to adjust to him was automatic. It was like, okay, daddy's home, and that's it. You know, because I had them ask him permission for things, even though he wasn't home.
I see.
It was to let them know that we are a team.
One would think, one would hope that after going through all of that, that finally you were on Easy Street and that life would be good, but there was more tragedy to come. Tell us what your life is like today.
I lost Tony 5 years ago. He had a heart attack. And for a while, I was alive but not living. I started writing this book almost 7, 8 years ago when he was alive, and I put it down because I was not ready to share. A couple of years ago, I picked it up and I started writing again. And it became extremely therapeutic for me to release all these emotions. And I actually started feeling like I was living. And I channeled all my love for him into this platform that I created. The book is one thing, but I've also created this platform to uplift and inspire others, because I have a purpose resonates with each and every one of us. And if I can help someone by sharing my story, it gives someone hope. We must never forget that we have to help each other to overcome. So if someone was to share their story, it may help someone else who may feel defeated and lost hope. We're not alone in this world. You know, and the platform is to make people aware that you're not alone. The feedback that I received from my book was, you know, my uncle did this to me and I never spoke about it. You know, it's that taboo, as you said earlier, so many. It has occurred, but people are ashamed. And we need to release that shame and say, no, this happened. So it can stop.
Yes.
I think back to if I had told my mother when I was a little girl, I could have prevented things occurring to other little girls, because he continued. But I was not sure, and I was ashamed of what occurred.
Well, I'm not sure you can entirely take that on. You don't know what would have happened if you had told your parents. You don't know if they would have believed you. You don't know if he, in fact, would have stopped. I mean, those are just things you know, you can't take on ownership for his ongoing criminal behavior. That's probably something you want to kind of let go of for yourself.
And I'm working on that because, you know, I have taken the blame for the other little girls that experienced what I did. And, you know, saying to myself, the what if, I should have said something. I don't know, like you said, if my parents would have believed me, if he would have stopped. I don't know, but I still, it doesn't minimize the guilt that I feel that now another little girl's past has been tainted because I didn't speak up. And I'm working on that.
I'm glad.
That I'm working on.
I'm glad. Because you owe that to yourself to be able to know that if another little girl's past is tainted, it's because of what he did, not mm-hmm. because of what you did or didn't do.
Mm-hmm. That's extremely difficult to come to terms with, but I will say I am working on it. I have spoken to some of his, some of the other little girls, and they actually said, it's not your fault, you know, Carmen. I am sorry that you know, so it's kind of like a support, I won't say group, but we have acknowledged that we're not to blame, but it still doesn't ease that pain, that guilt that I feel.
I understand, but I'm pleased to hear that you're working on letting yourself off the hook for that one. And your website is ihaveapurpose.com, which I'm hoping that folks will take a look at so that they can get more information about the book and about the other things that you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. I have a blog on my website, which is www.ihaveapurpose.com, and I encourage the listeners to go on and share a story because your story, as I said, can make a difference to someone else, and it's all about empowering and uplifting one another.
Absolutely. Carmen, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your story with us today.
Pamela, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It's available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or from the Google Play Store. I'd love to hear from you with any questions or comments. By all means, send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.